It's Dig Deep on KEXE KBXE with Aaron Brown and Chuck Marone. As we take up the topic of the rural-urban divide, this time some ideas on what could change where this has to be. And I think you ended our last segment, Aaron, kind of talking about...
Well, I talked about healthcare a little bit, and I talked about how there is a need for, on issues like that, some kind of breakthrough.
Yeah, you were talking economics, where where people might actually be spurred on to do something in rural areas.
Let me give a policy.
Economics.
Let me give a policy discussion, because I do think that this is where something needs to change. Let's start by saying that in general, and there are some exceptions to this. There's some extremely poor urban neighborhoods, but in general, if you are rural, you tend to be poorer. You tend to make less money. You tend to have less discretionary disposable income. You tend to be less educated. You tend to be poorer. And so in an old school, like Democrat-Republican kind of back and forth policy discussion, the party of the poor people, the poor, the downtrodden, the working class, that would have been the Democratic Party.
Farmer Labor, yeah.
The Farmer Labor Party. A big part of, and we can look at the 1996 Clinton administration Welfare Reform Act. We can look at a lot of the pushback to social benefit programs. A lot of that feedback has come from resistance from rural areas, from small town people. And I think some of the dismay of urbanites have been, why are these people voting against their own self-interest? Why do these people not want these benefits? Why don't they want universal coverage? You know, why are Republicans now who are going there against all these things that are going to disproportionately help their constituents? Let's go back to the very first segment. And when we talked about the social contract, the idea that you have a kid here and you're relying on your in-laws and your family to help watch it. And there's a certain like relationship back and forth with that. And we like stand by each other and we do those things. Now, for the most part, that's true. That's how it works. But we all know that there are also people where that doesn't work, where they have dysfunctional families or things don't work. And what we have decided as a social contract is that you step in and we'll help those people. We'll help those people with food stamps. We'll help those people with assistance here or there. If you're in an urban area, that's fantastic, because your social contract has no social bonds that go with it. It's not like you're helping your mom and then your mom expects you to come back and help her. It's like you're paying the au pair. And if you can just get some help doing this, it gives you the next level.
It becomes a cost of doing business.
It becomes a cost of doing business.
Living in a city.
In a small town, in a rural area, this has a totally different dimension to it that I think is not well understood. When you say, well, you know, we're going to help that young single mother because that young single mother needs help, I get that argument. Like, I'm not trying to argue against that. Like, I don't want that kid to go hungry. I get that argument. That's like an easy argument. What we often throw away then is that now that young single mother doesn't have to go to her mom for help and doesn't have the kind of social pressure parenting advice that comes with that and all the other things. Well, that's okay. Mm-hmm. We'll have a early childhood program for that kid, or we'll have. And I think in rural areas, when we don't acknowledge that social contract part of this conversation, what we do is we just impose urban policies on rural areas in a way that I think are going to be rejected. They're going to continue to be rejected and looked at, even if they would be helpful.
So this gets me thinking a little bit about the phenomenon of, in political terms, some college. The people who tend to vote most conservatively are those not with no college or college degrees, but people with some college. People who tried college, maybe emerged with some debt, maybe emerged with something, and they come out and for whatever reason, the upward mobility of the promise of the great American educational system failed them in some way, or they certainly feel that way. And the some college people, and because I work at a community college where 40 to 45% of the people I see don't finish it with a degree, for whatever reason,
right.
I know who these people are. I can put names and faces to them in my head. I don't doubt that a lot of them vote very conservatively, particularly among men, because they view this big social spending of higher education and all the things that go with the social democratic philosophy, they view that as a failure because they saw it, tasted it, didn't like it. It was a failure to them. And they're trying to get by on their own. And I see a lot of that in our rural communities, people who have seen the benefits. Maybe they know people who exploited the benefits. Maybe they heard about a person who exploited benefits. Maybe they see people who aren't the best example of why we should have these programs. And because it's a small town, and like I said, I see faces and names, they see faces and names, and it becomes kind of a very personal thing. So that's part of the idea here, too, with why some of these big things go that way. The other thing I was going to drive at with regard to the rural-urban, I'm not a rural-urban, the urban policy you said applied to a rural area and why that might not always work is because in an urban area, you truly can be temporary on benefits, on welfare.
Right.
You truly can be temporary on food stamps and maybe go to college, use it to get your college degree, and you can get a job and you can be off those benefits. And that's the whole point of why they work. That's the whole point. It's temporary. In a rural area, and I saw this in reading a lot about Appalachia and some of the problems you see in Appalachia, but also the problems you see here. It works the same way. Let's say you're a rural person, you believe for cultural reasons, like we just talked about, you should stick around, help your family out, and then you like living here, being around them. So you go to college, and maybe you finish college. You get a degree, maybe you get a job, and if your prosperity improves, you're going to share it with your family.
Right.
You're going to help them out, help out your cousins, your neighbors, your relatives. If you have kids, I mean, how many rural people do you know who have achieved some success in life, but have maybe even gone bankrupt because they helped their kids?
Tons.
Tons.
And not only that, but just the like modest little day to day. I mean, like silly things like you go out to a movie and who's expected to buy popcorn, you know, who those, there is a certain amount of, and I'm just going to call it attachment and social attachment that on one hand is oppressive. On the other hand, is very deep and binding and beautiful. And I think that when we ignore that, we miss something.
So this kind of relates to a couple things. One is in a communal, like a small town environment where it's very individualistic in terms of like values, we work and we...
Rugged individualism.
This ethos of work has been passed down.
Right.
And at the same time, your accomplishments are shared with your family, not with everybody, not with random stranger down the street, but certainly with your family and your kids in particular. Some of the most conservative people in terms of giving money to the government are extraordinarily, ridiculously over-generous with their own family.
Right.
And so...
And give to church charities and other things.
Yeah, yeah.
But the idea is it's that the kid down the street that I don't know, there's a program, there's a charity or something else. But really what should happen is that kid's family should take care of them. And if they don't, we're going to kind of ostracize that family as like a social pressure kind of thing.
So I guess what we're both, I think we're kind of moving in the same direction
here. I think we are.
Is the idea that there's a translation from the way those social support networks are supposed to work and do work. And this is the liberal talking. They work great in certain situations, and they work great in helping kids who are left in bad situations, and they work great in helping people who are in transition. And they work in rural areas too. They can. But the problem with you that you see is that people get caught in bad situations because they're talking about two different like coding languages for how society is supposed to interact with the government, for how society is supposed to interact with the common, the communal, as opposed to the individual. And so I think from a policy standpoint, since that's what we're trying to talk about here, we have to try to figure out how we can talk to people who are going to be helping their family with the money they get and who might even make bad choices with their own family, what we would call bad choices. Instead of going to school and finishing that degree that they got financial aid for, that they maybe even took out loans for, they're going to stay and help their mom or dad or do something with their family and then go into debt for a degree they don't finish. You know, that's a poor choice, but it's made not for poor reasons. So how do you relate that to a policy outcome? And then the other thing I want to talk about with rural areas as it relates to policy is the notion that our problems are changing. You know, when I was growing up, there were no jobs because our industrial jobs were automating and farming. This happened in farming areas too. The farming jobs, farms were going away in favor of retail jobs and low-paying jobs. What do we do now that with this generational shift happening, what do we do now that these places can't hire people who meet their criteria? They can't get enough people. And yet there are people who say they're underemployed and don't have a high enough wage. Like, we have this disconnect. And so I think part of the policy, and I happen to work in higher ed, but I think there's some responsibility on the interchange between our rural schools and our rural colleges and technical colleges, trying to relate how to get people ready for the new economy in rural America and everywhere, while still valuing these cultural things that we hold so dear in these areas.
It's interesting. I don't know as I fully understood what you meant about the choices. Because I actually maybe am going in a different direction with this. I kind of look at, gosh, I don't want to be like the downer person here, but I look at two like trends happening at the same time. I look at rural areas getting poorer and poorer and essentially not sharing it. This bifurcation of our economy is real. And it's real a lot along these urban rural lines. It has that very much component to it. Because if you want to achieve something today, you go to a big city. That's where you, if you get left behind, you stay behind and you struggle more. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to overcome that in many ways. But we're trying to overcome it with a lot of like urban solutions, trying to bring big city solutions here. I actually feel like a big part of what we need to do in small towns, in rural areas, is embrace the things that work really well here. Part of that is a slower pace of life. Part of that is church and school and community and volunteering and, you know, all the things that kind of bind us together even more. Some of it is like the old-fashioned barn-raising kind of mentality, making a comeback. And I think we can nostalgize all those things as good. They were good, but that the reason that those things happened is because that was all people had. Like, if you were going to have a barn, you had to have a barn raising. Mm-hmm. And that meant you had to go help someone else's barn raising. Yeah. And because you were not going to order a barn and hire someone and have them come in and do it. You didn't have the money. You were poor. So I actually feel like a part, this is one side down, like downer, and one side, I think, pleasant. I think we have to, in a sense, start to adapt ourselves to a lower burn rate society financially. I think if you were just an economist with a spreadsheet, say a lower quality of life, if you measure quality of life by things, but a higher quality life in terms of community and people and us living together. And I think in rural areas, in small towns, you can actually make that trade-off. You can actually give up one for the other and be better off. Mm-hmm. That's not how urban areas measure success. That's not how macroeconomists measure success. And if we're going to stay stuck in that bubble, like that's how we're going to measure success. How many iPads do we have? How many internet connections do we have? How many cars driving down the street per day? How many fast food joints do we have? We will lose that game and our lives will grow increasingly harder and more difficult and less rewarding. If we can switch the way we keep score, in a sense, and start to emphasize things that are different and better for us and more suited for us, I think we have a different set of outcomes.
The other thing that I follow what you're saying because
and I feel like that sounds a little like naive. You're like, oh, let's just all get together. But it's
and whether you can formalize that, but like I think about like what makes some of these towns that are doing better than other small towns, and you know all about this, but like I'm thinking about my hometowns on the range, the places where I'm from, and there are some places doing really cool things. It's typically because people spend a little bit of money and a lot of time doing something. And the other thing I wanted to point out that I think is important is that rural, and this is maybe the underlying thing behind the misunderstanding of rural areas, is that rural areas aren't just one thing. You know, one of the things I love about small towns in northern Minnesota is the interesting people you find that are not typical of even what we're talking about, like random strange things, the guy who digs ditches but is quotes Shakespeare and that kind of thing. Those are the kinds of things that are interesting. And I think one of the things we find is that rural areas are poorer, just like you describe. Typically, a person in an urban area or especially a suburban area is an average person has a lot more money than an average person in a rural area. But in rural areas, we have a very pronounced divide between those who have and do not have, and the range being a classic example. We associate the range with mining and miners and people who serve the mines. We elect our people to be kind of aware of and advocate for the mining industry. And in rural areas, it's farming and things like that. Everybody's got their industry. But people who work in those main industries that we talk about that have now consolidated and automated so much, they're generally doing a lot better than your average person. And this is something I see working as I do at the community college, and being from a kind of a blue-collar, working poor family in a lot of ways. Some of us are middle class, some of us are working poor. And the difference is pretty pronounced. And it's actually showing up in my family dynamic, because there's a lot of people who make very, very little money who live in rural, in our listening area, you know, where we're talking right now. They make very, very little money. And they don't work in mining, and they don't work in farming, and they don't work in these industries that we associate with our area, wood products. They don't work at the paper mill. You know, they work at the gas station, or they work at, you know, they assemble mailboxes at MDI, that kind of thing. Those folks, and by the way, they vote Republican or Democrat. It's not just that they're one party, but they're not included in the conversation about what we should do. And they're the ones whose prosperity determines whether or not our region succeeds, yeah, I think.
I think you're right. I think there's a nuance on it, though. In urban areas, there are desperately, desperately poor people. But you can be a middle class, working class, affluent, whatever it is, and go your whole day without meeting someone in a different social class than you. Mm-hmm. If you live in a suburb of the Twin Cities area and you got a house that's at a $250,000 price point, you live in a neighborhood full of houses with people at $250,000 price points. Mm-hmm. And their social understanding, their background, their affluence, their vacations, like everything's going to be very similar to yours. Mm-hmm. You might be half a mile from a place with price points of $500,000 mm-hmm. or $100,000. And those people are going to have completely different, separate and isolated lives. And you can go an entire existence without running into someone. Here, you cannot. You cannot live in a small town without having, you've got to work at it.
Yeah.
You've got to be very disengaged. Yeah.
Just because your public school
Your family includes people of all different price points. Your kids' friends
we have advanced,
are going to be at different...
Yeah, we have advanced degrees and no degrees and GEDs in our family all at the same table.
All at the same table.
And that's very true. But I guess what I'm getting at is that when I do a project in my college class, I get to persuasion. I have them form groups, and I have each group decide what a community problem is in our community, and they can just define it however they want. And they have to come up with a solution and a call to action so that we can do something. Each of us watching can do something to help make it better. And I would love for the people who get elected out of our rural area, Democrats or Republicans, and this is where I say it, I mean, it sounds kumbaya, but I would like them to really know what people who aren't engaged with politics and the traditional industries of our area, which are now the minority of employees in the rural areas, I would love for them to know what's being said. And perhaps it would change the priorities in a way that would unify rural areas and make us stronger because we're helping our own people. And I think there's a lot of people in rural areas that get ignored. And I think when you talk to rural people in general, what do they say happens? We're being ignored.
Right.
Whether they're Republicans or Democrats, they feel that rural areas are being ignored by these big cities that have power, that have money and influence over our lives. And we have no influence over their lives, and we have no ability to change our lives. And that's a very frustrating experience.
But I think this is why Republicans are going to be in the wilderness, in a sense, for a long time. We're going to be the party of the rural area.
The aggrieved and fearful of change.
The aggrieved and fearful of change rural area. Because if you are an urban area, I can come up from a federal level with all kinds of progressive policies mm-hmm. for you that are completely transactional that will make your life better.
Yeah.
But if I am a rural area, the policies can't be transactional. They have to have mm-hmm. this social depth to them. And the only thing I can come up with is to resist the boogeyman and make a populist message of how this is all evil. And really, the only thing I have to offer you is become poorer and do barn raisings and work together.
Yeah.
That's not like a very popular platform to run on.
Mm-hmm. And it holds no appeal to people who honestly think we can do something else.
And it holds zero appeal.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's a little frustrating because I do see, I mean, the places that I run into that are doing the best are the places where you have active groups of people working together mm-hmm. outside of what you would call normal structures to do things, to make things better. And really, that's almost an anti-policy. It's almost the antithesis of policy.
If you're going to be isolated and cordoned off from our economy, then some sort of self-sufficiency is the solution. The problem we see, a mayor of a town that just got reelected on the Iron Range in the candidate profile ran on the issue of, I'm going to get the government to give us more LGA funding.
Right.
And like, that was what he put in the paper as his solution to the problem.
Right.
Like, that's not, I don't think that's the solution, nor do I think curl up and die is the solution. So that leaves something else in the middle of all that. And that is, you know, what are you going to do to encourage groups to act and function in this new reality? I think a lot of rural people feel kind of frightened, and really the idea of sitting in your rural house and watching cable news and having reactions to things that are on the news. I know a lot of rural people, retired people, who sit at home and do that, and it's terrible for them.
Let's talk and about
I don't
that
care
one.
Whether, I don't care whether it's MSNBC or Fox News.
Right.
You know, it's not a good environment. You need to be out in your community doing what urban people take for granted, which is seeing a lot of people. I think we need to do more of that. And I think that's the ticket to us doing better as a rural area.
Let's talk about that one in the extra. Because okay. I would like to, I have a real gripe with the media today.
Yeah, maybe that's where we, that's where we do our media stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think we got to.
Aren't we all three in media?
We are.
Yeah.
Okay.
But well, we're the good ones.
Sure, of course we are. It's Dig Deep on KAXE, KBXE, Aaron Brown, Chuck Marone. Thanks for tuning in.